Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to The Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. This week, we chat with Robbie Martin, who is a filmmaker and who, along with his sister, Abby Martin, is the founder of Media Roots. We're going to talk about the completion of his long documentary, A Very Heavy Agenda. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with Robbie Martin.
Robbie Martin, welcome back to The Soapbox.
Thank you, Cindy. Glad to be here.
And it's nice to have you back. So before we get into talking about your documentary, A Very Heavy Agenda, you recently attended a fundraiser, which you describe as neocons for Hillary Clinton. And so, first of all, it's very timely because we were shown the spectacle of the Democratic National Convention. I think politics in the Democrat and Republican arena, I think that they're not as real and not as entertaining as professional wrestling. And so it's very heavily scripted, very orchestrated, stage managed. So it just really, now that the whole Sanders, to me, fakery is over. A lot of people are jumping on Clinton's bandwagon. So talk about that basically neocons for Clinton fundraiser. And how did you get to attend that?
Well, it was completely open to anybody who was willing to donate a certain amount to Hillary Clinton. So up front, I'll say that I am ashamed for contributing money to her campaign, but it was the only way to get into this event legitimately.
Right.
So I did it with the intention of kind of infiltrating the event, but I did it completely officially. I didn't sneak in. And I didn't present myself, I didn't say that I was someone that I wasn't. I presented myself as Robert Martin, filmmaker. And I just kind of left it at that unless anybody asked me any more specific details, which they did. Actually, I talked to Robert Kagan's daughter, and I felt almost too sad because, I don't know how involved in this his daughter is. So I didn't have the heart to tell her I had made a 7-hour documentary about her family.
Right.
but so this event was really interesting to me because it wasn't a big surprise to me that it was happening, because about 2 years ago, I think he's from the New York Times, a writer named Jacob Halperin, who's fairly generic. He's not really like that, he's not like that much on the left. He's not really an anti-war critic, but he was writing articles about 2 years ago before Hillary Clinton even announced her candidacy, saying that Hillary Clinton was trying to reach out to a neoconservative sect in Washington, D.C. And I don't think many people this article didn't get picked up very much. It was just kind of out there. It was a mainstream article, but it just didn't seem to have much of an impact. And then when Hillary announced her candidacy, it was clear that Bernie Sanders seemed to be, at the very least, I was never really a fan of Bernie, but at the very least, he seemed to be forcing Hillary a little bit to posture herself more to the left, kind of as a counterbalance. And of course, that didn't really end up working too well in the end, as
right.
We've seen. But with that happening, I think that, I kind of thought, well, maybe these neocons aren't really going to have an opportunity to join up with Hillary Clinton. But what happened was when Trump started to, the only way I can describe it is outflanking the left on the sort of anti-war rhetoric he was using. Until that happened, I don't think the neocons really saw an in or an open window to really join Hillary's campaign. And once Trump started to talk about how he was against the Iraq war, which we could argue, you know, that's kind of I think it's kind of phony that he's saying that, but he's still saying it.
Mm-hmm.
He's still rhetorically acting like he's kind of almost like from that Ron Paul, Pat Buchanan style of, you know, not engaging in frivolous wars around the world. And once that happened, and once Jeb Bush pretty much dropped out of the race because Trump clobbered him over not keeping us safe on 9/11, the neocons went into full panic mode in D.C. And somehow, this is to me the most amazing part, is somehow they came out of the shadows and they very openly started to endorse Hillary Clinton for president. Now, these are all mostly Republicans, so it's actually a historically kind of unprecedented thing for this many Republicans, especially like neocon intellectuals, you know, sort of, I would say almost like the top of the GOP establishment, defecting to the Democratic Party, essentially,
right,
and saying that this is our candidate. She is much more aligned with our foreign policy than Trump. And, you know, you can go down the list. It's like one of the only neocons who isn't on board with this is Bill Kristol. But almost all the other mainstream neocons are Max Boot, Elliot Cohen, even Jamie Kirchick now is saying I'm with her, and Eli Lake and Robert Kagan, all completely endorsing Hillary Clinton now. And this fundraiser was officially announced on Hillary Clinton's website. That's to me was the most amazing thing when I realized, oh my God, this is completely official, no longer in hiding. So this bridge that they've built to Hillary Clinton, they've successfully built it, and it's there now, and you see them using it to sort of act like they're you know, they're even using it to say that Hillary Clinton is the only presidential candidate in this race who's going to uphold the sort of NATO traditions and the NATO obligations, because Trump said he doesn't care about NATO. So even in that realm, the neocons are really behind Hillary. And then even more alarmingly, you know, you're starting to see that neocon rhetoric spill over to the left now, where it's Trump has become this Russian Putin Manchurian candidate who has now hacked the DNC to alter the election. That's a narrative on the left and the Democratic side right now. And I would argue that's straight up neoconservative anti-Russian xenophobia. So that's kind of where we're at now, and I'm pretty alarmed by it. But yeah, I mean, I'd be happy to talk about this fundraiser some more if you wanted to know some.
Yeah, no, and while you were talking, I don't know if Barbara Bush actually said she was going to vote for Clinton, but she said she couldn't vote for Trump, and I think that's like the stance of the entire Bush family. But I know Laura Bush has, I think, come out in favor of Clinton. And if that, all of a sudden these people, when you talk about the left and the Democratic Party, that doesn't resonate with me. But many Democrats are now like putting these things forward, like the Bush family all of a sudden have turned brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, when for 8 years, they were the lowest scum of the earth, but now that they are in congruence on this Clinton question, they're brilliant. And this is another thing, when Trump talks about NATO, many people on the far left, like me, we want the U.S. out of NATO. We want the U.S. out of the U.N. The United Nations and NATO are just manifestations of the U.S. empire. So, but I don't think Trump is brilliant because he's saying things like that. Do you kind of know what I mean? Just because there's some like agreement doesn't mean that like all of a sudden the Bushes are brilliant or all of a sudden Trump's brilliant. I don't know if it's a coincidence or whatever. But you talk the Democratic Party, people On the Democrat side, they're actually promoting these things like it's a good thing. If Barbara Bush ever endorsed me, I would immediately renounce that and denounce that. But she would never would anyway. what are your thoughts about that?
I mean, I need to clarify probably that I am completely not pro-Trump in any way, and I think
right. I'm glad you're telling my listeners because I know that.
Yeah, and that's sort of the problem. That's how I think a lot of people more on the left side are getting boxed in by this, because there's so much pressure and so much fear where it's like, how could you, you know, if you're not going to vote for Hillary, then that means you're basically going to be helping a white supremacist fascist. You know, mm-hmm. that's the narrative that's been put out. And it's unfortunate that things have become that, I guess, you know, the rhetoric has gotten to that level already. Because, you know, Hillary Clinton, I would argue, this is the argument I keep trying to make to people, and maybe you'll agree with this, you'll have to tell me if you do, mm-hmm. is that when Bush got into office, he accelerated a form of American fascism, especially after 9/11, that, you know, I had never seen before in my lifetime. And for people to just think that somehow that went away and that because Obama got into office, that that's not there anymore, I think is really strange to me, because it seems that's what people's understanding of it is, because now that Trump is sort of taking the veil off sort of this right wing, you know, rhetoric that was more, a little bit more coded before. Now people are saying fascism is coming to America. And I'm just really baffled by that, because, you know, I never saw it as gone. I never saw it as, oh yeah, Bush is gone, now fascism is gone.
Right.
It was always here.
Right.
I almost think that we were lucky for not accelerating more quickly into it than we have been. And, you know, I can't say that that's because thanks to Obama. You know, I can't say thanks Obama for pausing fascism. But... you know, the only thing Obama did, I think, to pause it was rhetorically. You know, he tried to not act as Islamophobic as the Bush administration. But beyond that, he didn't do anything to really reverse any of it. And that I think is fundamentally the problem. Obama allowed warrantless wiretapping to continue, didn't close Gitmo. He didn't do anything to prosecute the torture regime, or, you know, the people who were involved in that. None of the war criminals were prosecuted. So when you have that situation, fascism never left. So that's the part that bothers me, just on a, like, on personal level, for people acting like Trump is a fascist. Now, you know, some of his rhetoric definitely sounds fascist, but in my mind, a more dangerous form of fascism is the kind that's done under the guise of intellectual, you know, like this, like it's reasonable. And that's kind of what I see in the Hillary Clinton campaign, is at this fundraiser that I went to, they were completely comfortable talking about how Trump is endangering the world and the United States by pulling out of these alliances. And Kagan goes on to talk about what these alliances really mean at this fundraiser. And he essentially lays out the whole vision for American hegemony, that after World War II, when we turned Germany and Japan into puppet governments, that we were able to maintain stability and dominance over the whole planet for the greater good. And without that mindset, we're going to be pulling away from our obligations, you know, our duty as the world's superpower to rule over the planet and keep it safe. So this is definitely the Clinton mindset, and one of the most astonishing things to me about this event is part of it was supposed to be a, like, you can have a private face-to-face time, you know, with some of the speakers, and right. I bought a ticket for the event that allowed me to do that. So the whole time I was there, I was trying to build up my courage to go talk to Kagan. And I had all these ideas of things, you know, things to say, and gotcha questions and stuff like that. But the one that was the one I wanted to ask him the most was the difference between Hillary's approach to Ukraine versus Obama's. And I guess by asking him that, I didn't realize how candid of an answer he was going to give me. Mm-hmm. And he basically you know, it blew my mind that he started basically by mocking Obama for not wanting nuclear war with Russia. He was kind of like, oh, yeah, he doesn't want a nuclear war with Russia. That's why he's because I asked him, why is Obama seem like he's dragging his feet in sending weapons to Ukraine? And that was his answer. And it was just really incredibly strange to me that he thought that that was something worthy of mockery. That, you know, Obama's foreign policy record is horrendous, I will admit. But in this instance, I just don't understand how you could fault him for not wanting to escalate that situation with Russia. And Robert Kagan's perspective was that Hillary is totally comfortable doing that, and she will fulfill these obligations, and she cares more about Ukraine than the current president does. So the next president, regardless of who it is, if it's Trump or Hillary, they will probably send weapons to the Ukrainian army and escalate that situation, and that's very dangerous.
I just have an aside.
Sure.
This doesn't really like have to do with this conversation, but why do you call Donald Trump Trump, but you call Hillary Clinton Hillary?
That's a good question. I think it's
because it's like, I know that's the way she projects her campaign like that, right? She has an H, that stands for Hillary, but I think that. And I never would call Sanders Bernie either, because, and it's not so much because of sexism. It's because that I don't want to make anybody think that they're my buddies. Now, I would have no problem calling Fidel Castro Fidel or Hugo Chavez Hugo, because, you know, I think they are friends of the people, but I don't think Clinton, Mrs. Clinton, or HRC, as I like to call her, is a friend of the people.
No, I mean, I agree with you.
And this
you.
Is
I think
just my opinion, you know, and it's just something that really doesn't have anything to do with this conversation. But I was thinking of a different question when you were talking about the fundraiser and, about fascism in the United States. Of course, it didn't just start. I mean, it didn't just start with George Bush. What's happening, of course, is that white Americans are feeling the pinch more and more when, people of color, whether they're citizens or immigrants, have always been feeling this way. Obama hasn't prosecuted any cops who have killed black people or brown people or even white people for no reason, that obviously was illegal. What they were doing was illegal. Bill Clinton started the NAFTA, which has impoverished many workers here in the U.S., but most of the workers in Mexico that forces this immigration. Obama has deported more immigrants than any other president before him, yet people are upset about Trump's rhetoric.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, that's the interesting thing to me about it is, I mean, even if you go back to the Clinton administration, so many of these things that are squeezing minorities and the working class were set up by Bill Clinton.
Right. The repeal of Glass-Steagall.
Absolutely.
That caused the collapse of our economy, not Wall Street's economy, our.
Yeah. Are you still there, Cindy?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'm just like astounded. It's like, okay, we had Bush, Clinton, Clinton, Bush. Then we had a respite. I don't even want to say respite. We had Obama, Obama. Now we're probably going to have Clinton, Clinton. And this is just amazing to me, Robbie, that it's like the not the cream of the crop, but the crap of the crop is rising to the top. It's like people need to look up caucusocracy, because that's what we're in now. The very lowest denominator of our society are in leadership positions, And they're the ones who are accumulating all the wealth and really just like screwing us over. And the people just think, oh, if I just walk around the corner and go vote for somebody, that this time it's going to actually work. And I'm sorry I'm going off on these rants. I guess it's because those would suit your program better.
No, it's fine. Rant all you want.
When we do the one for Media Roots. But Robbie, so let's talk about your documentary. And it's really good and unique that you focused on these neocons and Robert Kagan. What a jerk.
Yeah, I mean, what was interesting is I expected him to be a total alpha male, condescending asshole to me. But because I was donating money to Hillary Clinton and it said it on my name tag, it was just fascinating the way he talked to me almost like a peer. I almost regret not talking to him more at length, and just because I just found it incredibly odd that while his wife was working for the Obama administration, still Victoria Nuland is still there, he's telling me, a total stranger, he's mocking the president's decision not to escalate into a nuclear war with Russia to me. So I wish I could have talked to him for longer. And I also asked him about Trump bringing fascism, and I kind of tried to pin him down about what aspect of Trump is fascist to him. And he made some joke about how, well, Trump doesn't speak German and he doesn't have a funny mustache, so people don't think he's a fascist. And he didn't really answer my question. But the next question I was going to ask him before he turned around and talked to another group of people was, how can you not see, you know, as a Hillary supporter, because I was going to play that card. I was going to be like, I'm a Hillary supporter, and I thought Bush was a fascist. So how could you not think why would you think Trump is a fascist and not Bush? And I'd be really curious to see his answer to that, because in a very heavy agenda throughout the whole series, but especially in part three of this documentary series, I show how many of these neocons, especially someone like Michael Ledeen, who I would almost describe as the Trump of the neocons, was saying things that were far crazier, more megalomaniacal, more narcissistic, just more insane than anything Trump has said during this entire campaign. And Michael Ledeen was saying these things along with a lot of other neocons right after 9/11. And, the only argument one could make to defend them is, oh, well, they were swept up in it all. They were emotional just like everybody else. But when you watch a lot of these video clips of the neocons right after 9/11, they don't seem emotional. They seem very, very calm and collected. And they are using the public's emotional hysteria to push through all this just insane rhetoric and posturing, which a lot of it actually became legislation. Looking back on the Bush administration, I think that there's a case to be made that Bush wasn't just pushing a lot of this propaganda out directly from the White House and the U.S. government. A lot of it was actually coming from his buddies and people who probably in some way were working with his administration on the outside to run flank for his administration. You know, and I'm not even just talking about people like Judith Miller and a lot of the generic mainstream media who was carrying water for Bush. I'm talking about specific group of neoconservative editorialists and writers who were also part of PNAC, who were putting out, you know, tons of stuff after 9/11. Michael Ledeen says that it's our messianic vision to topple any, you know, dictators across the world, to impose our will and our freedom and democracy over every other country. And he even admits that it's not about stability. It's about taking these people down. It's about winning. And America loves to win, and we hate losing. And that's why we must win. I mean, it's almost kind of like a neocon version of what Trump is doing now. And I think, I mean, I'd like to think I make a good case in part three for showing how hypocritical all these neoconservatives are for, you know, acting like they're so alarmed over Trump. And I would argue that they're using Trump as an excuse to make us think that they're our friends again, that they're normal, that they're not crazy. And I think that's a dangerous mistake to think that. And unfortunately, because a lot of them have created this bridge to Hillary Clinton now, I see a lot of people on you know, more on the left side of the spectrum falling for it. That Robert Kagan article about Trump being a fascist was all over the place.
Right. It's working.
It's totally working.
So, and then we look at, if we look at the Project for a New American Century and their paper, you know, their publications, and we look at the Middle East right now, it really, the destabilization and chaos was their plan. And I've been in the Middle East a couple times, and I've spoken with, you know, people, activists there, and parliamentarians in, like, Iraq's government, Jordanian officials and things like that. And they say that the destabilization, they call it the Lebanonization of the Middle East, to break up every country to, they could care less, they really couldn't care less if Saddam Hussein is the leader of Iraq, or, you know, Assad is the leader of Syria. They just want instability to make Israel feel safer in the region.
Yeah, I mean, I think Israel definitely plays a component in this. I think that it's, I mean, I think in a large way, the neoconservative vision believes that not only is America exceptional, but Israel is also exceptional. And sort of that union, and of course, Israel and the United States, when it comes to the Middle East, I think their goals are very intertwined.
Right.
And I think it becomes sort of a chicken and egg thing at a certain point, where it's like, well, are the neocons just doing this all for Israel? I think that in a large way, they're doing it, I would say they're doing it more for American hegemony, but yes, Israel plays a huge role in that, obviously. And neocons even are more hawkish than Israeli Zionist hawks, because they'll say that they'll want to invade any country, even if it has nothing to do with Israel's interests. And that's, I think, what we have kind of going on right now in the Baltics and in Eastern Europe. Is I don't think Israel and Russia are really, you know, I think they're allies from what I understand. I don't think that they want to be enemies. So it's interesting to me that the neocons have almost in a way completely veered off course from the war on terror, and now they're so focused on creating this posturing against Vladimir Putin. They want to turn Putin's Russia into the new evil empire. And as you can see with this whole Trump is a Manchurian candidate conspiracy theory, it's working almost too well what they're trying to do. And I just think everybody needs to, regardless of if you support Trump or Hillary, I mean, especially if you support Hillary, I think it's really important to just look at all this stuff, just to know who you're going to be voting for, because this is what you're going to get with her presidency. As much as you know, if you're a critic of Obama's foreign policy, and or if you were relatively okay with it, even if you say if you were an Obama voter and it turned out okay and you didn't think he did anything that wrong. Mm-hmm. It's a mistake to think that Hillary's presidency will just be more Obama, because from every indicator says that her foreign policy will be far more hawkish than even Obama's. And that's going to be really, really hawkish. That's pretty much going to be a Bush foreign policy platform. So,
or her husband. It was not, I mean, a few million Iraqis were killed during the Clinton administration, and talk about, you know, the Balkans and Eastern Europe and everything that happened when he was president. It's just, I mean, it's going to happen who's ever president, but we don't have to support it. That's what I keep on trying to say. We don't have to support it. I stubbed my toe the other day, and I blamed Putin on Facebook for that. Obviously, it must be his fault if anything bad happens, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's so funny how it just enables us to take away our own agency and look inward at ourselves. It's so convenient. I mean, it's actually brilliant how little they have to do to get everybody to just turn their focus away from how messed up things are here.
Right. And I just I'm just waiting for them to say that Putin is the head of ISIS.
Yeah. Because, I mean, honestly, that could come out, a story like that could come out tomorrow. By the way things are going now, I wouldn't put anything past the mainstream media at this point. I'm actually blown away by it. I mean, Abby and I were tracking a lot of this anti-Russian hysteria all the way back in 2014, you know, with the Sochi Olympics and how everybody was trying to say Snowden was a Russian spy. And we just never expected it to get to this level this fast. I mean, it's really frightening to me.
Well, even if Snowden were a Russian spy, do people think that the U.S. doesn't have any spies in Russia?
Yeah, exactly, right?
You know, that's the name of the game, right? Everywhere there, I don't know if the U.S. is actively operating an embassy there, but everywhere that there is an embassy or a consulate or an interest section, they're spies. And I mean, that's just what they've been doing since the beginning of time, right?
Yeah, that's what's so funny about it is you can assume that everything we accuse Russia of doing, we're already doing to them.
But that's okay because we're awesome. The United States is awesome.
Well, I always use this, it's not an analogy, but just this thought experiment where it's like everyone claims Russia is, you know, like only, you know, Russia is so corrupt that they kill journalists, they kill dissidents, you know, they censor, they throw punk bands in jail, you know, all that kind of stuff. But it blows my mind when you think about it this way, that America is the largest imperial power that's ever been on this planet. I mean, arguably, you know, technologically speaking.
Right.
And how it just doesn't even make sense that the world's most powerful superpower wouldn't kill journalists, or that would be beyond them to do that. I mean, so I just find that fascinating that people just think America is not capable of that level of corruption when it's, you know, anyone who's studied American foreign policy and sort of the CIA, you know, you go back only 20, 25 years and it's pretty obvious that that's completely within our capabilities.
I love how, you know, Obama went to Cuba and accuse them of having political prisoners.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, we incarcerate the most by number and percentage of any other nation out there. How many political prisoners does the United States incarcerate right now? But of course, they don't consider them political prisoners. I just heard that they were going to try to prosecute Chelsea Manning for trying to commit suicide.
Yeah. It's awful. It's a bummer that Chelsea Manning, you know, made such a huge sacrifice and, you know, Snowden I don't know if he's happy, but he's free, you know? Mm-hmm. It's a real bummer. I mean, at least Julian Assange and Snowden aren't in jail, you know? So,
right. And, you know, Sabell, you know, what's her last name? I can't think. Edmonds. She says that, you know, many whistleblowers did it and remained here to face the consequences because that, you know, unfortunately, it put Chelsea Manning in prison for decades, but at least I think it furthers the cause. So, and that's what Sabell thinks too. She really does not have any respect for Assange or Snowden.
Yeah, I mean, Assange is an interesting character because he's he's definitely got a big ego. Mm-hmm. But if I were going to choose between him and Snowden, I definitely would lean towards him just because I feel like Snowden's politics are a little bit almost too neoliberal for me or something.
Well, I totally agree. Maybe a little neoconservative.
At least Assange has a little bit of an anarchist bent to him.
I don't think there's a wide difference between neolibs or neocons anyway. So
not anymore. No, yeah. You're right.
So Robbie, we're actually out of time. So tell my listeners how they can access your documentary, and we'll also, of course, put links on the soapbox again.
Sure. So A Very Heavy Agenda is a three-part documentary. Each part is the length of like a full-length documentary, and you can watch all three of them together, binge watch it, or separately at averyheavyagenda.com, and it's streaming or for download for a low price. And I'm also selling DVDs of all three parts individually or in a box set. And the box set comes with a 30-minute bonus DVD of a bunch of stuff that some of it will be a surprise, some of it won't be. And I'll just spoil one of the surprises in it now. I haven't announced this yet, but one of them is an outtake from a Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson interview that Abby conducted, where she asked Wilkerson, you know, you wrote this anthrax speech for Colin Powell at the UN. What do you think now, knowing that the anthrax attacks were done by, you know, someone in our own government and it wasn't a terrorist? And it's the craziest thing. He acts like it was a terrorist, like an Islamic terrorist. And he doesn't even know anything about the anthrax case. What? He almost pleads total ignorance. And it's really unfortunate. And it's also surreal that someone who was responsible for making the case to the UN didn't even follow up to find out that, you know, it was based on total hysterical lies, essentially.
Well, so, good for Abby for asking him that. And that's another thing that drives me crazy. All these so-called Democrats who were excited because Colin Powell was voting for Obama. I'm like, you're excited that a war criminal who is one of the people responsible for so many deaths, you know, not just in Iraq and Afghanistan, but Vietnam, where he was a war criminal there. You're excited that a war criminal is voting for the same person you're voting for? That's disgusting. Colin Powell had a lot of respect from people, and he went to the UN and bold-faced lied.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's a component, you know, that I try to really lean on in A Very Heavy Agenda to show that it took people like Colin Powell to really make the sales pitch, because the neocons by themselves, they always need neoliberal and these democratic, you know, Democratic Party figureheads to really fully push their message.
And Hillary Clinton was one of those Democratic absolutely. Party figureheads that just lied as badly and boldly and baldly as Condoleezza Rice did. And one of my questions to you know, these liberal feminists is, well, if it were Condoleezza Rice running for president, would you support her just because she has a vagina?
Yeah, no, it's a great point.
Hello. I mean,
just really quickly about Hillary, I mean, the crazy thing is she acts like she regrets her Iraq war vote, but she really doesn't. If you look at what she said about it, she still to this day says that she believed Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons. I mean, that's insane that she could say that today.
Well, that's what Blair just said after the Chilcot report came out. Tony Blair, he said that it was the right thing to do.
Yeah. And Hillary Clinton, you know what? She would say that too if she didn't feel like she was forced to say the opposite. I'm sure that she, in her heart, she doesn't regret it. I mean, it's clear based on her reasoning now. She doesn't really fundamentally regret that vote.
Of course she doesn't. Well, she does, really. I had a meeting with some of her biggest supporters in California back in 2005. Rob Reiner, you know, the actor and director.
Yeah.
And Stephen Bing, who is a billionaire that was a huge supporter of Clinton and the Democratic Party. And they, at that point in 2005, were telling me that Clinton was the only hope to get back the White House in 08. And my response was, if she's our only hope, then we're really screwed, because she's a warmongering imperialist as bad as Bush. And you know what Stephen Bing told me? And he's a close advisor to her, even though he's kind of on the sidelines, in the shadows, really. He said, Mrs. Clinton will come out against the Iraq war when it's the right thing to do.
Wow.
Yeah, and so I was in Brooklyn not too long after that. I shared that with the people that were there, and Stephen Bean called me immediately, and he was so upset with me. I said, I don't really want your support if your support comes with the condition that I have to support her. And so then I had a meeting with her. He arranged a meeting with her, and personally, ethically, morally, and what's the other? I'm trying to think. Personally, ethically, morally, and in my public life, I would never, ever, ever support that person.
Yeah.
Well, just really disgusting. So, Robbie, wow, this went by really fast. You could probably use this interview, just replay it on Media Roots. Because, Robbie, tell my listeners about Media Roots really quickly.
So, MediaRoots.org is what my sister Abby started long before she was doing Breaking the Set on Russia Today.
Right.
And we interviewed you
long time ago,
which was awesome. And you were one of our first big interviews that we got for our site. And, you know, since then it's growing, but we don't update it too often. But when you go there, you'll always see our newest podcast, Media Roots Radio, on the top right corner. And we try to do that at least once every 2 weeks.
And I've loved you guys ever since you came to my house and we had that interview. It was really, really awesome. Well, Robbie Martin, a very heavy agenda, and Media Roots, thank you for being on the Soapbox.
Thank you for having me, Cindy.
Thank you.
That's the Soapbox for this week. As always, I hope you were informed and inspired to do further research and further activism. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, and I'd like to thank Robbie Martin for his work and for giving us his time on the Soapbox. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to the Soapbox. Peace out for now.